next case on our calendar is 97-2141, James Caldwell versus Treat Corporation. Justice Resnick has recused herself from this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Joseph Nara, who is a judge of the East District Court of Appeals. Mr. Ritz.
May it please the court, I'm Arlen Ritz from Toledo, Ohio, representing the appellant James Caldwell. The ultimate question that this case presents is a problem as to why a chair collapsed.
My good lawyer.
However, in order to determine how why the chair collapsed, we might wish to look at the chair. And the chair in this case was disposed of very shortly after the accident by the owner. This causes us then to proceed to a more philosophical inquiry as to what burdens of proof the different parties have and how the doctrines of res ipsa loquitur may or may not be involved. Now, this case is really about the phrase exclusive control. The Lucas County decision from which we appeal takes a very strict view of exclusive control, requiring the chair at all times to be in exclusive control of the defendant in order for the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur to be applied. Now, the Summit County Court of Appeals, on very, very similar facts, turned this around in a very interesting manner. And they say the cause of the collapse is in the exclusive control of the defendant. The cause of the collapse, because they have the chair. And the burden of explanation as to why it collapsed should switch to the defendant. It flows from something like the missing witness rule. The court, at page 26 of the appendix, says it in this way. It is a general rule that where a party fails to produce or to explain the admission of relevant evidence that is in his control or within his power to produce, the jury may infer that such evidence would be unfavorable to that party.
I wonder if we were to think of this in different categories, Mr. Britz, where it, in this case, a landowner disposes of a broken chair. Is there a different scenario about exclusive or the inference that's to be drawn by a jury? Why is it not here? Why is it not explained? If someone is injured and the owner knows that there's been an injury versus an occasion where it comes to the someone appears uninjured and the instinct of the property owner is to get rid of that chair, didn't seem at the time any purpose for retaining it.
Well, in this case, the patron was visibly upset. He thought he was hurt. He didn't know then that he was going to have to have a hip replacement, which is all that would happen. Certainly the seriousness of the injury was not known to him at that time. But the owner knew that he'd fallen, and I think there's a self-preservation says that when this happens in my business, I'm going to protect myself. So I don't know that there should be a major distinction. We can't show a willful destruction here because it's unclear from the evidence that's developed on the summary judgment as to whether or not the chair was pitched immediately afterwards or after I called. So there's an affidavit in there, a record indicating that I called Mr. Cascales and told him that there'd been an injury here and I wish that he would retain the chair. It was either on the day or the next day. It was very close to when it happened. And it may be that the chair was pitched before I called it.
Does that make any difference for res ipsa? In the Court of Appeals opinion, it says we believe the analysis in Cook is incorrect, as it's clear and well settled the doctrine of res ipsa applies only when the defendant has exclusive management and control of the instrumentality causing the injury at the time of the injury. Didn't the defendant have exclusive management and control of this instrumentality at the time it was causing the injury?
Well,
or is because this man sat on it, he has control of the instrumentality? Is that the distinction? I don't understand what the Court of Appeals meant, frankly.
Nor do I. Although the question wasn't certified here, I cite this Tennessee case, this recent case out of Tennessee, June 20th case of 1997, Byrne versus First Tennessee Bank, which goes to Prosser. And Prosser says control has been carried to extremes by many courts. And I think under the Prosser view of exclusive control, the defendant still has control.
Well, what do they mean here? What do they mean here that the defendant has exclusive management and control of the instrumentality causing the injury, and then find res ipsa not applying because they have to say the defendant didn't have exclusive management? Now, how did the defendant, who did?
Well, what they're saying, and I'm arguing for my learned friend here,
it's fine,
is that maybe my client leaned back on the chair, or maybe he sat down real hard on the chair.
Well, isn't it also that he was too heavy for the chair?
Well, I don't know that in this day and age, a restaurant shouldn't be able to seat 300-pound people. As I argue in the case, what would happen if the OSU team on its way to Ann Arbor stops at this restaurant for dinner? They have a lot of 300-pounders on that team.
We closed the restaurant. That's what had happened.
They should be able to go in there and sit down. 300-pound people are not that unusual.
It isn't the point is that someone sitting, and this apparently defendant had another incident where the person who leaned back before this, leaned back in the chair, came in and apologized, wanted to pay for the chair.
That's right.
Because they had broken the chair.
That's right.
That's, you know, you could argue the defendant there had exclusive control, but it's argued here. I don't understand the exclusive control argument here. A chair in a restaurant, yeah, that can be abused, it can be all sorts of things can be done to it. Now we have a 300-pound person sitting in it, and we're saying that the restaurant has exclusive control over the chair. I somewhere I've lost the track there. I'm not sure where. I thought res ipsa's used were traditionally in a surgery where somebody's abdomen is opened up and something happens, and so don't know what happened except that the doctor and the nurses have exclusive control over your abdomen. That's a little different than a chair with somebody sitting in it.
Or a chandelier fall.
Right.
I understand that.
And you've admitted this is a stretch for res ipsa. You want us to sort of stretch it because you can't get under the willful destruction of evidence. I guess I wish we could find a different way to get you there if we're going to do that rather than to expand. Res ipsa is such an old traditional doctrine that I guess to stretch it just to fit a case where somebody breaks a chair and some employee throws it out. It's a plastic chair. They get rid of it. They don't want somebody else to hurt themselves, I suppose. That's, I mean, as you said, there's no willful.
I guess there's no excuse that the chair as a result of the accident didn't break. Question is why it broke. And if we'd seen the chair the next day or the next year, maybe we would have noticed, or our experts would have noticed an obvious defect in it, so that should have been spotted.
Didn't he cut off your right of a products liability case against a chair manufacturer?
Exactly. That's one of the things I might pursue.
Res ipsa loquitur will apply here. What inference would there be that would be drawn?
Well, in the Summit County case, they allowed the jury to. The jury was given the standard res ipsa loquitur instruction, and the Court of Appeals approved that because it said that the means of defending against that were destroyed. Now, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
No, I think my question was, would it be an inference that the chair was defective?
Yeah. But the inference would be that the chair was defective because they went out and destroyed it so that it couldn't be examined. And maybe they knew it was defective and didn't want us to see that it was defective.
And that's the point I was getting to.
Right.
There's also an inference that they knew of the defect.
That there is such an inference that can be drawn. And I guess we're here on summary judgment. This is strictly a question of how the case is to be presented to the jury. The question I present is, which rule is fair to an injured person? A rule which rewards the landowner who destroys the evidence, or a rule that protects the patron who is deprived of the opportunity to inspect the chair? I think if the question is put that way, the answer is easy. The Summit County Court used what I think was some very creative thinking to show how, in these cases, exclusive control is no barrier to recovery where the instrumentality is under, apparently, Ohio law, under defendant's exclusive control.
If res ipsa is applied here, is that exclusive evidence of negligence, in your view, or is it just a matter that can be rebutted by the defendant?
I think it can be rebutted by the defendant.
Yeah.
I think it's just creates an inference, and it's not a, we're not asking a direct verdict for the plaintiff in this case. We're just asking that this case go to trial and that the instruction be given to allow that inference to be formed.
If the I'm with Judge, same with Judge Nara, I have the same question about which inference, because we could go through, he took you through two scenarios, an inference that the chair was defective, in which event that wouldn't go to the negligence of the owner, which is the only defendant here, right? Do you have two defendants? Do you have a chair manufacturer?
No.
Okay, so the so if the chair is defective, that's another case, which we don't have here. And then you said that what's the next one?
The next is
that the owner was...
If the owner got rid of the chair, there may be an inference that he knew ahead of time that it was defective.
Well, res ipsa doesn't go to those sort of things, does it? It goes to the negligence.
Traditional res ipsa does not go to those things.
Right.
Correct.
What negligence would it... I mean, the one I could imagine would be... It would inference that the owner failed to properly inspect the chair.
Yes.
Is that, I mean, which one are you going to ask us to evaluate here?
Well, that's one inference that a jury could...
But that's not what we're talking about, counsel, are we? We're talking about the legal doctrine of res ipsa, and if its application here goes to the defective chair, there's no defendant for that cause of action, so we might not use that. Right?
That's right. It would go to their knowledge of whether there was a defect. And they can rebut that. I mean, they claim they inspected the chair, and I suppose the mere fact that they said that doesn't prove it. The jury can determine, after seeing the witnesses, whether it believes that these chairs were inspected so regularly as they claim in their presentation here.
Do you think that the Ninth District, in deciding their case, decided on the basis of the majority decision, decided on the basis of res ipsa?
Is that the Summit County case?
Yes, sir.
They say they did.
Well, when I read Judge Quillen's concurring opinion, he makes it very clear about res ipsa, which leads me to believe that he at least thought that the majority opinion was not decided on res ipsa grounds.
Well, he said that the mere fact that the chair collapsed in this point invokes the doctrine of res ipsa. It doesn't create strict liability, but it creates a permissible inference, he says, which merely gives the plaintiff to the jury.
Which, as I understand it, is what you're asking for.
Well, that's what ultimately I'm asking for. I'm not quite sure that that's the question that's certified here. But I believe that people that go into places and the chair collapses under them are entitled to get to a jury on that, and perhaps up to the defendant to introduce evidence showing why he shouldn't be held responsible. I'd like to reserve my remaining time.
Thank you, Mr. Fritz. Mr. Watkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to sort of request that I not be asked to sympathize too much with Ohio State, but begin by protesting what I perceive to be factual misstatements that have been made in brief on the advocate down here on matters of some importance. The appellant's merit brief, page 7, refers to our failure to produce the chair as requested. This record I submit is devoid of any request made on behalf of the appellant or his attorney at any time to produce this chair for examination. It never happened. The evidence in that regard is entirely Mr. Ritz's testimony that he called and made that request, which Mr. Pachalis did not recall. He recalled those inquiry about the restaurant's insurance coverage. 2 years goes by, and
when did that inquiry take place?
I'm sorry?
When did that inquiry take place?
I'm not sure. Mr. Ritz has told us here today for the first time, and I'm aware of it could have been the day after this happened.
And there's nothing in the record.
The only thing in the record is the affidavit of Mr. Ritz and the testimony of Mr. Pachalis that he can't recall exactly when it was made. But he believed it was shortly sometime.
So shortly after the accident, there is a call from an attorney saying, who's your insurance carrier?
That's what's his recollection. And he is denying. And
specifically with respect to this incident?
Yes. There is no basis, as I tried to indicate in briefing, as counsel has committed for the first time today, there's no basis to conclude that the chair did not already been discarded in the ordinary course of business.
So the spoliation of the evidence is, you can't get there from here.
You cannot get there, and today for the first time that has also been invented. Cannot prove destruction. So 2 years goes by.
At some point your client does say, don't have the chair. Is that, I mean, in the summary judgment, in some fashion or another, your client has said, we don't have the chair?
That's correct.
Okay.
And during this deposition in February of 96, some year and some period of time after the case was filed, they found out for the first time, he said, we believe it was discarded by an employee.
Counsel, the bigger picture question that he's putting, customer comes into your client's restaurant, sets down a chair, collapses, your customer's civilian on the floor or on pieces of the chair on the floor. Why isn't that enough to get to a jury and then you both have to struggle with the absence of the chair?
Well, it's not enough for several reasons. I respectfully submit. It's not enough because that is clearly what has been requested here, an imposition of strict liability.
This
client's client, I see.
Is that it?
I'm not involved here. Well, strict liability is liability without. If you want to impose strict liability, don't use racism to do it as he wants you to extend. Because that's a negligence concept. And I would like to point out that the appellant was not as helpless here as he claims. Mr. Pachalis himself testified he saw the chair and he believed it was the back leg, left leg that was broken. The waitress was there. The appellant saw the chair. His lunch companion was there and saw the chair. There were other chairs of the exact same type. He was not as helpless as he could have, as he would lead you to believe. It was as Edwards, as both, well, among other things, he could have done what this McConnell report did that Mr. Burns has brought to the court's attention. He could have somebody come and take a picture of him, and an expert in that case was permitted to testify based on pictures of the chair. You know, it's important to understand here the difference between him and this.
Well, if he's got his own testimony, I sat on the chair,
collapsed,
I got up, I saw that the one leg had snapped off. I've got other witnesses that can come in and show that the leg snapped off.
Then he would have an arguable product liability claim for a design defect against the manufacturer. He would have. I mean, and that's what the court, both courts below, and that's why I take issue to the appellant's statement, although this is a certified conflict case, that this is just about exclusive control. It's not. Both courts below, I thought we were reviewing judgments here. Judgments of both courts below, in addition to the exclusive control issue. One could reasonably draw an inference inference that the accident was due to a cause other than the negligence of the defendant, such as faulty design to accommodate someone the size of the plaintiff, fatigue of the plastic, or a defect in manufacture. That was the trial court and the court of appeals. The court of law also reached the same conclusion. The argument that we should extend res ipsa, a traditional negligence concept, to strict liability is what's being made here.
And there was evidence shown in the summary judgment, the hearing, that that's the fact?
That what was the fact?
But you just said that it's a faulty design, nothing else. Was that offered?
No, there was not evidence of that. No. Let me make it clear. This is the finding of the trial court in analyzing and rejecting the res ipsa loquitur argument here.
Okay.
They rejected it because the other prong was not, it could not be met by appellant either. They're here about exclusive control, but the other prong, and the reason why it was rejected, was that it was required that this be a circumstance where an accident does not ordinarily happen in the absence of someone being negligent. What he wants to accomplish here is to change that prong to say, this is something that happens that does not ordinarily happen unless someone is liable. Not negligent, but liable, strictly liable. Res ipsa loquitur is a time-honored and well-tested doctrine. It has limitations. They admit they can't meet those limitations. And the only reason we're here today is because some extended period of time after this occurred, they found out at a time when no request had ever been made to see the chair, that the chair had been discarded in the ordinary course of business.
Are you saying that a restaurant owner in like circumstances is only required to keep the broken chair or the broken table, whatever they allege caused the injury, only if they're asked to keep it? He has no obligation whatsoever. He can throw it out. If someone the next day just come in and say, listen, don't get rid of the chair because we may need it, he has no obligation to keep the chair. He can do whatever he wants with it, knowing it has caused someone a possible injury in his establishment, and it may certainly be a focus of some further inquiry?
I believe in that circumstance, Justice, that this court has addressed his remedy. This court has addressed his remedy for interference with or destruction of evidence in the form of creation of a spoliation cause of action that they admit they can't meet here. This court did that in 1993 in response to a certified question from Smith v. Howard Johnson. That's why I talk about spoliation in my brief. They don't just want to extend and change the res ipsa from negligence to a strict liability scenario. They also want to create an exception to the cause of action that they have but can't be spoliation.
Is it a given in this case that the defendant was not in control of the instrumentality, since that seems to be part of the question that was certified here? I understand it. The question is whether destruction of failure to produce evidence and so on should allow the application of res ipsa loquitur, even when there is a finding that the defendant is not in exclusive control of the instrumentality.
It's my belief that the court below did make that finding. I find this somewhat confusing about control of the type of conversation.
Good.
I do.
Okay.
Control of the instrumentality at the time it causes the injury. I guess I sympathize with and agree to some extent with some of the opinions I've read that have said that there were equal access to some patients before they had more loss, things like that. I see the other side of it too. It's kind of a nebulous concept, but I don't find in this reply brief, I'll suggest that if this case is remanded, the courts below will make a determination as to whether or not this case falls within the parameters of whatever decision this court answers to certified question. My concern about that is that it ignores the findings of both courts below that the other clause of racism has not been met. This is not a situation that ordinarily occurs only when someone is
negligent. From a practitioner's standpoint, assuming your facts here, that this was a day or so goes by until this person
assume, based upon the question, that there was a friendly creature who was still in the exclusive control of the restaurant's
corner. And they say you could call the world's restaurant.
Are you trying to call these?
The sheriff's gone.
But they made this one already.
Is there...
Is there that?
Had this in his part filed an action against both your client and the jury.
That's why I was confused by the lawyer's opinion. They both agree now.
Is that sufficient then to dodge someone
against the chair manufacturer? It may well be. Because he had the opportunity to look at the owner, the exact chair.
Well, now you've got both the restaurant owner who may or may not have. I mean, this may be a chair for which there is no
state designation.
There are no bolts to tight or joints to degree glue or any of those kinds of things. Well, maybe there are. But you've got the two potential responsible parties in court. And so I answer witnesses saying that a leg snapped off. Because the universe is possible right now,
opinion is clearer than the Court of Appeals opinion on the issue that you're arguing?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely, on the issue of the problem of racism.
Yes, sir.
I guess most of the comments that I had intended to make were pretty much already discussed in questions. I would close with a reference to the rationale for the imposition of this adverse inference instruction that's being sought here. It is evidentiary, and it depends upon the assumption, validity of assumption, which I question here. That is, we got rid of the chair because we're trying to cover ourselves and must have something wrong. And he wants a deterrent here that is not warranted by the record. The Welsh case I cite on page 9, 10, and 11 of my brief discusses these rationales in some detail in the Sixth Circuit. The most important thought I would leave you with is to reference the
Very good. Let me
actually say it's a little over a minute at this time.
No, thank you.
So page one of the supplement's merit brief, the statement is, I asked Mr. Koskalis not to dispose of it last year. That's what's in the record for the purposes of summary judgment. We don't know whether he'd already done it or not.
The question that is presented to us says that even where there is a finding, I assume by the trial court, that the defendant is not in exclusive control of said instrumentality. The trial court make that finding from the evidence or from the summary judgment that was cited?
The trial court found that on summary judgment, yeah.
That you failed to prove... You failed to prove that the instrumentality was in exclusive control of the defendant.
That's what the trial court found, yes.
Okay.
He did?
It was a Judge Jensen?
Judge Jensen.
What he found was that none of the facts presented in this case point to the negligence of the defendant. One could reasonably draw an inference that the accident was due to a cause other than the negligence of the defendant. He didn't say anything about control.
That's a question.
I could see.
That's a certified question.
That's a certified question.
I know, but Judge Sweeney's question was, did the trial court make a finding of control?
Right, and he didn't.
And they did. They moved it to the Court of Appeals who made the finding of control. Isn't that right?
Thank you.
Counsel,
you may be excused. We have a
commission
ceremony.
No, I'm not disputing that.
No, I know, but I mean...